Okay, I think we can begin. My name is Jack Gilmore, and I was the person that gave the talk at the second lecture series back in June. The first one was with Bob Everett, and he covered whirlwind. I covered the early graphics work on the TX0 while it was at Lincoln Lab, and then some graphics work on the PDP-1 that went to iTech. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge a few people in the audience. First of all, we have one of the fathers, or if not the father of timesharing, John McCarthy. John, you want to stand up and say hello? We also have Marvin Minsky, father of artificial intelligence. And I believe Ted Johnson is here or should be showing up shortly, but he certainly did a tremendous amount of work as far as getting digital off and running as far as sales was concerned. We are celebrating, by the way, the 30th year of the PDP-1, so, and this is quite significant. This evening will be exciting, I'm sure. And then last but far from least, I'd like to welcome members of the press and media. I have two slides that I'd like to pop up, and then I'll turn the meeting over to these youngsters. May I have okay, I need more that light down, please. We need more lights up. Do I have light controls here?
It might be over there.
Oh.
Just turn everything. Just hit them all.
Push things down.
Okay. At the last lecture series, we talked about the TX0 and the early graphics work that was done there, and the advent of the light pen by Ben Gurley, and the early ScopeWriter graphics work that was done. And then we pointed out that this was really the beginning of three other branches, one going straight ahead to the more conventional but still very exciting graphics work that Ivan Sutherland and others developed on the TX2. The one in the lower right was described by us in the same lecture series, the drafting, electronic drafting work that was done on the PDP-1 at iTech. And so we left the upper right-hand corner, namely the MIT TX0 story and the PDP-1 story to be told this evening. And we like to kid these fellows because we had a 65K version of the TX0, and when we gave it to them, we only gave them 8K. So they have a story to tell on what they did with it. It's on us. By the way, I would like to make one other comment. I forgot. There's an individual that isn't with us who played a very major role in the development of the work on the TX0 and then the PDP-1. That was namely Ben Gurley. And unfortunately, Ben died a tragic death in 63, but I just felt it was appropriate to remember him as well tonight. Okay. You're looking at the right stuff of the early computer world, and so dig in and have a good time. Thank you.
Yeah, I wonder if that makes me Tom Wolfe. My name is Stephen Levy. I'm the author of Hackers, which had a few nice words, probably not enough to say about the PDP-1. We have a terrific panel of people who can tell you all about the computer, which was, you know, as I found out when I researched the book, an incredibly significant advance, one which is underappreciated. So rather than my tell you what I found out from them, let me turn it over to them one by one to tell you about it, and then we'll open things up where you could ask them questions and they can contradict each other and maybe blow some holes in apocryphal stories or whatever. I'll only stand up here for the first one. Our first panelist is Jack Dennis, who at the time that PDP-1 was delivered to MIT 30 years ago, maybe a little less, was, I just joined the faculty as an assistant professor. Now he's a professor emeritus, and he's going to talk a bit about the TX0 and PDP-1.
Well, the TX0 arrived at the MIT Research Laboratory of Electronics in 1959. You have to realize that at that time, the computing environment, what sort of computing environment there was at MIT, the Whirlwind computer, which was the first powerful stored program machine operating at MIT, was decommissioned when? About that time. The main computational facility at MIT had become the IBM 704 installation in Building 26 at the MIT Computation Center. Now, the way the 704 was run, basically it was a punch card operation. What you did was you brought your deck of punch cards to the door, passed it in to the operators, and a couple of hours or the next day you'd come back to see what your results were. And that kind of operation was very discouraging to many people, particularly to John McCarthy here, who wanted to get some really good AI programs operating and couldn't see how they could be developed well unless you had more a more suitable way of interacting with the machine. So that was the motivation behind the development of the time-sharing idea. And in anticipation of that, the TX0 was run at MIT as a kind of open shop system where programmers or users could come in, have the machine entirely to themselves for a period of time for which they would sign up. Now, at the beginning, what we had to work with, what we got from the Lincoln Laboratory, was the hardware, as Jack pointed out, 8K of memory, 18-bit memory. And you mentioned that at Lincoln Laboratory, the TX0 had 64K of memory. Well, 64K of memory requires a 16-bit address. Now, with 18-bit words, how much does that leave over for an operation code? It leaves 2 bits, okay? So when TX0 arrived at MIT, it had a 2-bit operation code. Okay? Now, talk about reduced instruction set computer. This is a reduced instruction set computer. Well, we only had 8K of memory when the machine was delivered to MIT, so we decided to take some advantage of the 3 extra bits that were left over, and so we implemented a 5-bit instruction set, slightly less reduced, but also fairly effective for our uses. The way the machine was used at MIT was as a laboratory tool, for people in the research laboratory of electronics to use to connect to their experiments, to process data from instrument recordings on magnetic tape, and so on. It was very much a hands-on kind of operation. To support that work, some interesting software developments were made. We received from Lincoln Laboratory a tape called UT3, Utility Tape 3. This was an interactive debugger, but you could only talk to it in terms of octal addresses. And if you were trying to develop a large assembly language machine code, it wasn't too convenient to simply work with octal addresses. So Professor Thomas Stockham and myself developed a program called FLIT. And does anyone know what FLIT actually is? It's an insect spray, right? One which you kill bugs with. Okay, so that's what FLIT was. It stood for FlexoWriter Interrogation Tape. Okay? So we put that together. Now this was a symbolic debugger. It actually could use the symbolic addresses from the symbol table generated by the assembler. Another innovative feature it has, it allowed breakpoint tracing of programs at execution time. And as far as we can tell, this was the first interactive debugger with those two facilities, both the symbolic addresses and a breakpoint tracing of program. The other piece of software which we developed for the TX0 was a macro assembly language program. This was an evolution from a tape which we also got from Lincoln Laboratory, a paper tape full of holes, you know. And The paper tape we got from Lincoln Laboratory in this case is for a very primitive assembly language program, which came as a binary tape with no listing to it. So the first thing I had to do with it was decompile it to find out what it really was doing. And that was kind of tricky because some of the tricks that one could do on the TX0 with its primitive instruction code were very, very subtle. Like after you had completed a successful comparison, you knew that there was the number one was left in the accumulator of the machine. And you could, a neat trick was to use that one to index something else that you needed to index. So tricks, there are a number of tricks of that sort which one could use in this program dependent upon. Well, I developed a macro assembly language program, assembler program from that, which was called Macro. And eventually that got translated into a program, a similar program for the PDP-1. Now, when the PDP-1 arrived as a gift to the, generous gift to the MIT Electrical Engineering Department from DEC, John McCarthy was around with his advocacy of time sharing. So we decided that, yes, we're going to develop a time sharing system for the PDP-1, which we did, and that went into operation, demonstration at the end of 1963 and operation with users during 1964. This was an unusual form of time sharing because we wanted it to support the kind of use that the TX0 and the PDP-1 were being put to within the laboratory for research laboratory of electronics, which was to work with various laboratory groups in hands-on computation within the laboratory. So this time sharing system was not designed for remote use, but designed for shared use of the machine within the computing facility itself. There are a couple of interesting things about this time sharing system. One was that it supported interaction of time shared programs with user I/O equipment, I/O devices, and that's something which even modern systems are fairly weak on. The other thing was that we put in a trap facility into the PDP-1 such that the debugger could be fully protected from users' programs. So we could run our DDT debugger, which we developed for the PDP-1 on the basis of the work on FLIT earlier. We developed that so that no matter what your user program did, it couldn't upset the debugger in any way. And the facilities which we built into the PDP-1 for that purpose, it seems to me, were taken over later by DEC in the PDP-1145. I'd be interested in knowing a little more about the history of that development. Now, I might point out some interesting ideas in this time-sharing system. One was the swapping drum. DEC put together, with the advice of Ed Fredkin, if Ed is here, Oh, hi. I haven't said hello to you. Ed Fredkin came up with this idea that a drum in one revolution could exchange an entire contents of a field on the drum, put that in the memory of the computer, and at the same time read the memory, the information in the core memory out to another field on the drum. So we had DEC build two of these drum systems, one for Ed's machine at both Brannick and Newman, and one for the machine at MIT. Now, at MIT, we started out with only 4,000 words of memory in our PDP-1, and how are we going to make a time-sharing system with only 4,000 words of memory? Well, what we did is we wrote a mere 500-word executive program which sat in the top piece of this 4,000 words and did all the work associated with buffering, teletype, characters and doing the primitive scheduling of the machine. Later, we managed to get enough money together to buy three more banks of 4,000 words, so we could allow programs to be either 4,000, 8,000, 12,000, or 16,000 words in length. And well, I think that's most of the story, that most of the innovations I have to mention to you. A little interesting note was that a lot of the work in the connection with the TX0 and the PDP-1 were done by groups of undergraduate and graduate students. the undergraduate and other hangers-on became known as the Hackers. And part of that started because I have a history of, as an undergraduate at MIT, with being involved with the Tech Model Railroad Club. And it seemed that the Tech Model Railroad Club was an interesting place because it had this huge system built with telephone relays that could manage the operation of the trains around the layout of the club's HO gauge layout. And one time I said, well, gee, the people over there might be interested in seeing what the computer facilities are that we have at in the MIT Electrical Engineering Department and the Research Laboratory Electronics. So I invited a whole bunch of them to come over and see. Well, when they saw what was there, they got really excited about it and started making very good use of these computer facilities. And a lot of that is what you will hear from now on from my colleagues on the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, our next panelist is currently a professor of physics at Boston University, but 30 years ago he was working at a BBN and laid claim to the title of the best computer programmer in the world. This is Ed Fredkin, of course.
There was, in the Heinz Auditorium, I believe, something called an Eastern Joint Computer Conference that I went to, and I'd heard that there would be a machine there from Digital. Digital made modules in those days. And I went down there, and there was this machine, the prototype PDP-1. It was like a dream come true. It ran as fast as machines that cost millions of dollars, but it was priced at 120, actually 80,000, I think, with 1,000 words of 18-bit memory. That's like, you know, 2K bytes. But that was a lot of memory in those days. And I was watching it, and I ended up right then and there doing my first bit of debugging on the machine, because about every 3 or 4 minutes, the machine would suddenly stop, and the people there would, you know, look perplexed and start it up again and so on and say something, well, it's a new machine and so on. So I started snooping around, and I discovered behind this machine was a large copper strap with a wire going to the machine, and I followed the strap over to a booth, several booths down, that had a tape drive with these huge motors that went clunk like this, you know. And every time they would push the button to start the tape drive, the PDP-1 would stop. And asking a few questions, I discovered these were the only two booths that requested a ground wire. And so they supplied them each with a ground wire that just went from one booth to the other and nowhere else. So unhooking that fixed the problem. So there I ran into Ben Gurley, whom I had met before, and he is the designer of this machine. It was really a brilliant concept, and I want you to understand how Digital came to the conclusion of what it was that was to be designed. You know, they designed, this machine was just right. What were the specifications, I asked? What were you told? What was your charter? And I knew that he was hired by Digital, you know, at some point and said, design us a computer. So he said to me, he had the following conversation with, Ken Olson and Harlan Anderson, who ran the company. He said, you know, we'd like to hire you, design us a computer. And he said, what kind of a computer? And they said, out of inventory. Namely, this was a company that financed itself with very little money, and there was this stock room. And he was to look through it and see what was there. The truth is, he had to design about half the module types that were used in the computer, but that was the general idea. It was really a brilliant conception. So, I decided that we had to have one of those. I worked at BBN, and I argued in politics there, and we got, of course, we bought the very first PDP-1 and had an enormous amount of fun with it. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that John McCarthy and Marv Minsky hung around there, and this had a dramatic effect, I think, on the use of the PDP-1 and computers in general. And all kinds of things were done. And one thing that Marvin and I were sort of reminiscing about is that ever since the PDP-1, we've been wanting a machine that you could do something, you could do with the PDP-1, which is write some simple code and say, here's an XY, put it up on the screen for me. And all displays have gotten so sophisticated, you can't do that unless you're some kind of gee whiz programmer. And someone should make that possible again, and maybe give Marvin a machine like that, and something new will come out of it again. As was mentioned by Jack, the PDP-1 was one of the machines that sort of pioneered timesharing. The other, of course, was the 709 of the compatible timesharing system. And John McCarthy was at BBN, and one day he explained to me the idea of timesharing. And he had the right idea, and we worked at trying to make that happen. And, of course, digital helped us by—we invented, an interrupt system and the drum system and all those things, and they all got built. Those were the days where you could say, hey, I need this new instruction. It's really terrific. They'd go and wire it up, and the machine would have a new instruction. I'd like to tell you an anecdote which you don't know, and which means that really that the PDP-1 is in some sense still alive. I started a little company, and I located it in the mill in Maynard, and I had a PDP-1, naturally. And one day I brought a friend of mine there to look at it. His name is John Koch, and he worked for IBM. And I showed him the machine, and we spent a lot of time and explained to him the architecture. Ben Gurley was there. And at that time, Ben Gurley had left Digital and worked at my company. So we had a great time. John Cox, a computer architect, and Ben Gurley was. And we went through the machine in great detail, the intricacies of its design. It was all really good stuff. Later on that week, I got a call from John Cox. He wanted to tell me something funny. He said, I was visiting my father. John Cox is a Southerner with a Southern drawl, and he's saying, and I described this mill where your company was and where Digital was, and my father said, tell me more about that mill. It sounds familiar. And so John kept describing it, and then finally his father said, oh, I know that mill. The American Woolen Company used to be there. I used to own it. And so John Koch's father used to own the mill that Digital got started in. Well, here's the interesting thing. Many years later, one time late at night, I got a call from John Koch. IBM recently had a John Koch celebration on a weekend. They invited people from all over the country and spent 3 days doing nothing but heaping honors on John Koch. What I discovered is that there are all these people other than myself who got these late night calls that lasted for 2 hours or so while John Koch told all of his interesting ideas. So I thought I was the only one until then. But in any case, I got this phone call, and John said, do you remember that machine you showed me in the mill in Maynard? And I said, yes. And he said, I have this idea. And he described the idea, which was he'd worked up a design that was based on the PDP-1. Had a very simple instruction set like the PDP-1. PDP-1 had a multiply step and a divide step instead of an instruction. Well, he'd come up with a modification of that that did 2 bits at a time instead of one and handled the signs properly instead of not handling little things like that. And the whole thing, and he had in mind that it would have a 16-bit word instead of 18, and one other change he had in mind that the timing cycle, instead of being 5 microseconds, would be 5 nanoseconds. And he had this all worked out in his mind, and he'd shown that this machine could emulate every model of the System 360 in faster than real time. Okay, so his idea was that they should build machines like that, and part of his idea was to have a very clever compiler. That was different. But the architecture was the PDP-1. Of course, that machine is alive and well. Today it's called the RS-6000. It went through the 801 and a lot of evolution, but that project got started right then and there, and it absolutely started with the PDP-1 as its idea. So, to me, the PDP-1 was one of the great experiences of all time because I was always perplexed that they didn't sell thousands of them. I think they sold 120 or something. And, one day I remember John and I don't know if John will remember this, but had this idea that this was such a great thing, we should convince Digital somehow we'll go out and convince other people to buy these machines or do something like that. The world took to the idea slowly, but to those of us who sort of appreciated it, this was just sort of a miracle completely out of left field that there was nothing else like it anywhere in the world. So I think that the world owes quite a sort of debt to Digital for this PDP-1 because it was the germ that started a tremendous number of things. It was the first really fun interactive computer. It was fantastic to sit at the terminal, have the scope there, and we made it make music and fancy pictures and started things that ended up being word processors and real-time control programs and all kinds of things that hadn't been done before because the machines you needed cost millions of dollars and so on. And So that was the future that arrived, sort of burst on the scene and really captured the imagination of a lot of people. And I think that its story really ought to be known because it's a great story. Thank you.
Our next panelist is currently an electronics consultant in California, but 30 years ago he was a research assistant with John McCarthy, and perhaps he's going to tell us how he unleashed the curse of the video game upon the world with the PDP-1. Here's Steve, also known as Slug Russell.
Did see the PDP-1 at that Eastern Joint Computer Conference and thought it was interesting, but it was awfully crowded, and so I didn't have a chance to play with it at the time. And when the Digital donated the PDP-1 to MIT, I was down the hall and came in to see it, and belonged to the Model Railroad Club, so we talked about it a little. And I thought it was a great thing because it was the first appliance computer I'd ever met, and probably one of the first appliance computers. It had a switch, you could turn it on, you got a satisfying clunk, and it started working. And when you were done, if there was no one else to use it, you turned it off and left. And the other computers of my experience, if they got turned off, it was a major trauma, and you know, 5 vacuum tubes burned out and field service had to come and dance around it for a while to make it work again. It was also a very satisfying machine because you could type a single character at it and it would type a whole message back at you. Granted, it was a little cryptic, but gave you a great feeling of power, much better than flipping switches. And it had a cathode ray tube so that you could draw pictures. And I got a real itch to use it and started thinking about what I could do with it. Marvin Minsky had written a little demonstration program that made interesting kaleidoscope-like patterns on the machine. And it was interactive. You could put in different starting numbers and it would give you different patterns. But it wasn't terribly exciting because most of the time when you put in a new pattern, it didn't work very well. So the play value wasn't really too good. And so I wanted to use it for something. We talked it around at the Model Railroad Club and the Hingham Institute, dive on Hingham Street where some of us live. We eventually decided that, gee, you could probably simulate spaceships. And thought about that for a while, and eventually I got shamed into writing the code to maneuver a couple of spaceships around the machine in two dimensions. And fixed it so that two people could play. And then there was a great deal of kibitzing about the speed at which it ran, and there really ought to be gravity to be properly realistic. And so Dan Edwards wrote some gravity routines and put them in. And then Pete Sampson complained that the star map wasn't really properly realistic, and he put in a star map. And Shag grumbled about the explosion when you went into hyperspace. It seemed necessary to escape into hyperspace every now and then. Helped make the game more playable. And so Shag put in an improved hyperspace, put in hyperspace, and then things went on from there. And the whole process only took, I guess, a couple of months all told. But it was great fun, and it created a real problem because it made it a little hard to use the machine because you had all these space war players to kick off. And it became necessary to publish a policy that space war was playing was absolutely the lowest priority thing in the machine. And fortunately, debugging new versions of space war was higher priority. And you know, if you think playing video games is fun, writing video games is even more fun. So that's how Space War came to be, and it appears that it was the first two-person interactive game played on a CRT. And the people who made the most money off it were the patent lawyers who are still discussing this. I think a great deal of credit goes to John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky and Jack Dennis, who encouraged everybody around to try things and were not at all critical and radiated a lot of enthusiasm, which helped us try all sorts of things that eventually turned out to be interesting. And I think really the most significant thing was the thing that people get in personal computers now. You sit down, you have something to do, you poke at the computer, it does something, and you find out about it right away. No muss, no fuss, no bother, no wait. And the PDP-1 really started programmers thinking about how to do that and how to do it well. It took them about 15 years to figure it out, but I think it's much better now.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Our next speaker, perhaps picking up the thread from that, is currently a freelance writer, but back then he was also hanging around MIT and as a Higham Institute fellow, thinking, of course, about space war and hyperspace. This is Shag Gratz.
Glad Slug mentioned the lawyers. First 2 days of this week, I was down in New York and New Jersey doing some software detective work indirectly for the lawyers for a lawsuit that I call Space War East. The people at Magnavox who have a patent that they are using to insist that they have the authority to license anyone who writes any kind of interactive game, video game, computer game, whatever, periodically get sued by other companies who think that, well, no, this isn't quite right. First place Magnavox's patent only came out in 1967, and of course the first thing that they adduce as evidence to the contrary is Space War. So this has happened about three times over the last 15 years, and at various times, Slug, Marvin Minsky, John McKenzie, other people who were involved, and myself get called and come and help out to see what we can do. So it's still going on. The PDP-1 lives both in body and spirit, I guess. Anyway, all I want to do is take a slightly different thread, or actually maybe more than one thread, because it's not just people who are actively involved in electronics with digital or with MIT that got involved with this, and it's that's only one of the ancestors or the one of the progenitors of Space War. I probably have the least legitimate credentials of all the people here to be called a hacker. I did go to MIT. The first thread starts there because one of my first and still one of my closest friends was Wayne Wheatonen, who was a mathematics major and one of the few people at the time, this was in the middle 50s, 1954-55, when at that time at MIT the only computer that was doing anything, the only digital computer, was Whirlwind. But like the TX-0 later, it was also available to people who wanted to do research. Wayne was one of those who got involved with Whirlwind, so he was, as an undergraduate, a very early programmer. We became good friends mostly through activities in the Outing Club and our interest in science fiction. That continued after first I flunked out, and then I flunked out again, and at the same time Wayne left because if he had stayed, he would have flunked out. And one thing led to another, and we went through our necessary 6 months in the Army, and we came back out, and we lived in a cooperative house for a little while, and then found our first genuine grown-up apartment, which was, as you've heard, on Hingham Street in Cambridge, right down in Cambridge Park, right by the river. Why we called it the Hingham Institute was because it made us sound important. It was just a plaything, really. Now, at that time, I was looking for something that was better to do than be a research assistant in a chemistry lab, because that's all I really knew. I was out of work for a while, and it turned out that at Harvard, where Wayne was working as a programmer at the Litauer Statistical Lab, they needed a machine operator, comma, junior, which is the bottom of the totem pole. I got that job. It paid about 50% more than I could get as a trained chemist. That started that thread going. By that time, we had become friends with Slug, and we were all avid outing clubbers. We went hiking every chance we got. The other thing we did every chance we got was to buy and read, or go down to the movie theater and see some of the out-and-out worst science fiction ever written and or filmed. The novels of Edward E. Smith, all about the Skylark of space and the Gray Lensman. Now, this stuff is 1930s pulp trash. It is tremendously exciting. And if you pick one up now, even these days, it's very difficult to put it down if you let yourself go for just a few paragraphs. But it is bad. And the same is true for all these science fiction movies that came out of Japan at the time from Toho Studios. We gave it the name Grade Z science fiction, which is certainly what it was. The best thing about it was the model work. They built these beautiful, intricate models of Tokyo, San Francisco, other places, and all these marvelous rubber monsters, the ones you'd be most familiar with, Godzilla and Rodan, but there was a whole family of them. And they also had spaceship epics with model spaceships, weren't quite as successful somehow, probably because we knew more about all that kind of engineering stuff than we did about monsters and Tokyo. But these two concepts sort of got fused in our minds. And the first thing we thought of was, well, the obvious thing to do is they should make movies out of the Skylark of space. Until 2001. Star Wars is probably what the Skylark of space would have been. It's virtually the same plot, really. But at the same time, we were working first at Harvard. Then I left Harvard Statistical Lab and went to work for another old friend, someone I had met when I was still an undergraduate at MIT, Professor Jack Dennis, who at that time was head of RLE and was master of the TX0. He hired me for, pardon me?
I was not head of RLE.
Pardon me. He was in LRE, but he was the master of the TX0. This is a research lab of electronics. He hired me in the summer of 1961 to write a diagnostic program. This did two things. It gave me some employment for the summer, and it also set me on the path I was going to lead as a software writer. I wrote a diagnostic for the tape unit that was the Potter tape unit that was just then installed on the TX0. When that was over, I went to work for a man that we affectionately called Zeus. His name is Douglas Ross. He at that time was director of the Electronic Systems Lab, which was in a nearby building. And in the fall of that year, the PDP-1 arrived at MIT. Now, we'd been anticipating this for a number of months, and Wayne and Slug and I would get together at Hingham Street and think about what can we do to show this machine off, you know. And it always revolved around this business of spaceships, you know. Between the Toho Studios and E.E. Smith, it was all in our mind. Spaceships moving around on a scope. And it didn't take very long for us to come up with what turned out to be the basic rules of space war. The two spaceships opposing each other, firing something, rays or torpedoes or whatever it turned out to be, moving all around space and trying to blast the other out of the ether. And we thought it was a good idea, but at the time we didn't have any immediate way to implement it. Wayne got called back up into the Army after the Berlin crisis. But as Slug pointed out, some of the hackers that are at the Artificial Intelligence Lab had got involved in the discussions, and they were really quite eager to get going on it. And here was this machine. It had no software, just there dying to be used. Slug kept making excuse after excuse. What was he going to do? Couldn't write anything. Alan Kotok came over to deck, found a couple of mathematics subroutines, came back and said, here they are, write. So starting in January of 1962, Steve sat down, wrote the main control routine, and like Tom Sawyer with the whitewash brush, he got everybody else involved with writing pieces of this program. The first thing we had were the spaceships and the torpedoes and the acceleration. Then Slug threw in a few random stars. It was really the display of DDT sitting in upper memory. Understand, we did all this in 4K, no more than 9 kilobytes. Peter Sampson didn't like that, so he wrote the expensive planetarium, which displayed the stars of the central belt of, around the equator in their respective magnitudes, so the brighter ones looked brighter. Dan Edwards put in that star in the middle that had gravity, not particularly Newtonian, but everybody fell into the star if they didn't move. He also wrote a routine that compiled the spaceship outlines so that there wouldn't be any flicker on the screen. We were starting to exceed the refresh rate. Let's see, who else was involved? Pete Sampson, Dan Edwards. I was sitting there working on hyperspace. By the end of March, all this stuff was together. I should point out the hyperspace was where we inhaled the Minskytron. You'll pardon me, that's what we always called it. Professor Minsky always called it the tripost display, but we called it the Minskytron because that's what it looked like, you know, bore atom. And I found a way to make that display as the ship went into hyperspace. So out of these threads, MIT flunk out, hacker-type mentalities, science fiction, monster movies, and something that was a computing equivalent of a Heath kit came together in 1962, and Space War came out of that. It eventually showed up, I think, on every PDP that Digital ever produced and is still kicking around all over the place. I don't even know if it must be on the VAX somewhere. But anyway, that's how it all happened, and the rest, if you want to blame us for it, go ahead. We don't mind.
Thanks. Okay, next up is Dave Gross. Currently, he's a consulting software engineer. 30 years ago, he was a student at MIT. Who managed not to be around when the PDP-1 was delivered, but he returned soon afterwards to find our birthday machine sitting in the clues room. Dave?
I was sitting there trying to figure out what I was going to say and was realizing if this is a meeting of Hackers Anonymous, I would be up here saying, I am a hacker. And that's what I was back then. And as long as Shag's going to admit it, I was one, another one who had to escape from MIT before they flunked me out. And during that escape, that's when the PDP-1 arrived. But before I left, a friend of mine, Bob Saunders, I think I was actually his roommate at the time, showed me this little glossy brochure from some obscure company whose name I can't recall now, but I think it was Digital. And he showed me this brochure. It had two computers that they were going to advertise for sale. One of them was the PDP-1. I said, PDP, what's that? He said, that's a commercial version of the TX-0. I said, oh. The other one was the PDP-3, a 36-bit machine that Digital never actually built. And in fact, we didn't even have a prototype of it. BDP-1 was quite an advance over the TX-0, although it was obviously close relative. The TX-0 required some training if you wanted to turn it on. There wasn't one on button, and yes, you did get this satisfying clunk, but then you had to wait for the power supplies to warm up, because they're powered by, I think it's a vacuum tube system. So to do this properly, you had to watch this little timer, and you sat back and you twiddled your thumbs for a couple of minutes while it warmed up. Then there was another button to push that started the clock generator, and if you didn't do it right, or maybe with the button bounce, you might have got two. The clock generator was a chain of delay lines. If you didn't start it upright, you're in danger of overheating the circuits, I believe, because the two pulses in the chain is cycling the transistors more than they're supposed to. So you weren't supposed to turn on that machine unless you were authorized, and I wasn't authorized, and that really pained me. I really suffered. I knew I knew how to turn on that machine, but heaven help me if I ever did it, so I didn't. PDP-1 was quite an advance. We had those magnetic resonance saturating transformers that for the power supply that lasted all the way through the up into the PDP-10 generation. Those are the power supplies with the super heavy transformers, where if you open the the later machines that required more power, you open the back doors, the machine tended to tip over. And the PDP-1 was with those power supplies started. And the another advance in the technology in that PDP-1 was it had pulse amplifiers. The TX-0 had a delay line to generate the pulse trains, and then I believe the pulses were distributed to logic through just plain transformers, which meant if if you had to alter the circuitry somewhere and put more load on a pulse, you'd be changing not only the amplitude of that pulse as you're loading the one transformer, but the change would reflect back through the transformer into the main delay line and alter the amplitudes of other pulses other than the one you had. And the TX-0 had this oscilloscope over in the clock generator bay with little circles on the screen marking where the tips of the pulses ought to be. And if they weren't there, the machine was in serious trouble. And heaven help you if anybody changed the gain on that scope, because it would really cause a disaster. The PDP-1, on the other hand, was a relatively reliable machine, and it was really great for us hackers. Now, when my first stint in the computer room I was a witness to Bob Saunders writing this macro assembler, and it was a really, really fine product. Probably as good an assembly language as you'll even see on a PDP-11 class machine. And when I came back and there was a PDP-1, the work of converting that assembler from the TX-0 to the PDP-1 had already been completed. But I understand that Digital first was offering another assembler. Are you the author of that, Mr. Frank? Yes, this
is called
FRAP. Oh, yes, FRAP.
But it was written for the 1,000-word PDP-1, and it had to run there and with no auxiliary storage.
Now, get this. The original PDP-1 had a bi-directional paper tape reader.
Right.
I've never seen a bi-directional paper tape reader, but it was a very fine mechanism. It had two pinch rollers and two brakes, one on each side of the reading head. And the idea of this assembler was that it was going to punch an intermediate tape. I believe what you're supposed to do... No?
No, I'll tell you what it is.
Oh, yeah, I remember. You put the source.
I wrote it, I can tell you.
Okay.
That's why I know that's such a hack. You took the source tape and put it in the reader. It would read pass one normally, but then it was supposed to read the tape in reverse for pass two.
Yep, that's right. That's right. There was no room in memory to put anything other than the binary code you were assembling, so it read pass one, and it turned out that if you read the tape backwards, every definition arrived just in time for its use. By some miracle, this worked perfectly with no auxiliary storage needed for definitions. So.
Yeah. Needless to say, we were not in love with this assembler.
I thought it was fine.
I'm sure it would. Well, the crew consisted of, it was Samson. Were you in Boslog in that conversion? Or was it Kotok and Samson and a few others? They were given a challenge to do the work in one weekend.
Yeah.
And it was all-night sessions. And
Samson
and
Saunders.
Saunders would have done it too. And that wound up being the successful assembler for the PDP-1, too. It was a pretty neat job.
The other successful assembler.
Well,
it should be noted that the level of human engineering has still left some of us with the mnemonic for what to do with the switches when you got done, which was start to continue, continue to start. There was the start and continue buttons on the console, and unfortunately, the meaning of pushing them was reversed from what you wanted, which was what you had to remember. We've learned a lot. We've improved the human engineering of computers a lot. And if you wonder what's been going on between the PDP-1 and the Macintosh, a great deal of it is learning the hard way that start to continue to start and backward paper tape isn't easy to remember and easy to explain. And getting rid of this nonsense piece by piece.
Well, both the TX-0 and the PDP-1 were paper tape machines, but I believe Jack hired this grad student to do a magnetic tape controller for the TX-0. This grad student's name happened to be Gordon Bell, and he actually succeeded in devising a mag tape. Kotok and I were playing bridge one night in the TX-0 room, and the TX-0 room was a great place to play bridge in the hot days of the summer because it was about the only room in MIT that was air-conditioned for the computer. So it attracted us for more reasons than just the computer hacking. But we looked at that magnetic tape and thought, hey, there ought to be some way to save that rewinding that paper tape and rewriting it back into the assembler for a pass two. There ought to be some way to record the paper tape on the magnetic tape during pass one and play it back on pass two. And wouldn't it be neat if we could also put the resulting loadable image on that magnetic tape too? And between Kotok and myself, we came up with a patch for the assembler that would actually write source code onto the tape during pass one and leave lots of blank spaces between the blocks so that when it did pass two, it could also write the resulting object code and load it from the magnetic tape. And that was a kludge that wasn't supposed to be able to be done, but we managed to get it working. It was a pretty neat system as such things went. Another hack there was there to witness was Peter Samson's music program. Oh, yes. The TX-0, reminding me of another hack, the TX-0 had a hi-fi, a monaural hi-fi unit under the console. It was attached to probably bit 14 of the accumulator, some random bit that was determined by experiment to make the best sounding noises when you ran the average program.
In fact, you could tell when your program had gone into an infinite loop because the noise would go, your program was supposed to make, so it was a great tool. You could sit back and play bridge and not worry about the computer dying on you without you noticing. And Peter Sampson thought, hey, that'd be pretty neat. Let's use that to make music. And well, you know, he invented a scheme where he could compile a song, a tune, and play the melody on that speaker. When the PDP-1 arrived, he realized that was a faster machine, slightly better architecture, and he could actually code this up to have play three voices at the same time. And I remember when I got the first demonstration after I'd returned to MIT, he had coded up a Bach trio sonata, which is very good for a music system that could play three voices. And it was the one, it starts off as a solo for the first voice, and then it gradually brings in the second and the third voice until you're playing some fugue and goes on complicated variations. And it was sort of neat. I said, you play the, you know, it goes dum, bum, 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 bum. I said, oh, that's pretty nice, Pete. And then in came the second voice. I said, wow, two voices and then the third voice. And then Pete did the hack of hacks, I think. He had very carefully timed the paper tape reading loop so that it was a multiple of the sound incrementing loop. He could, when the tape read, when the music reached the end of the buffer, it read the paper tape while continuing to play the music in tune, which is a pretty neat thing to do on a machine that had a 5 microsecond memory cycle. And it would read the tape, and that had any number of people floored that it could do that, and with just minimal buzzing in the background. When we finally got the successor machine to the PDP-1 was supposed to be the PDP-6, and that machine was faster still and had the bigger computer word, and P. Sampson said, aha, I can now do a six-voice machine. And indeed, we designed something called the MK6, which stood for the Music Clued 6. Connect your PDP-6 to a speaker, and indeed, he did have a six-part music played on that machine. Another thing developed on the PDP-1 that I think is significant was a product of Phil and Dan Murphy here in the audience, the Mr. Tico. I remember Dan debugging Tico and thinking, gee, what a crazy thing to do. The right way to edit a paper tape is to use those Flexo writers. I'm an old stick in the mud, and I still like the coding of coding in the machine language for a machine that only had a 2-bit opcode. I think that's still what real programmers are going to do. And thank you.
I think it would be a shame not to hear if they'd be willing from some of our guests out here in the audience. I'm thinking particularly of Drs. Minsky and McCarthy and Richard Greenblatt. Marvin, would you like to say a couple words? Thank you. Marvin Minsky.